Tonight, I want to begin thinking about epistemology. Epistemology is a field of study that really tries to answer a pretty basic question. How do you know what you know? It's really a question about the nature of truth and the nature of the knowledge that we have. And it's really fundamental to the way that we're going to respond to the world around us. When I was a student, I had to deal with a lot of questions. Some of them were put to me by professors. Some of them were put to me by other colleagues, students, and they're important questions. One professor asked me point blank, how can any one person impose their religious convictions on somebody else from a different tradition with a different set of life experiences who doesn't see things the same way that you see them? And you have to think about that kind of question. You have to be prepared to answer that kind of question because it's an important consideration as we think about the nature of truth. I was reading C.S. Lewis. He's written a book called God in the Dock. It's just an excellent book, and I would recommend it to anybody. But he puts it this way: how can the religion that was begun thousands of years ago possibly be relevant for people that live today? Our situation is so different than their situation. And C.S. Lewis said it this way: it's a common reproach against Christianity that its dogmas are unchanging while human knowledge is in continuous growth. And it is true. When we think about knowledge, and we think about the things that we're learning, I understand that it took believe it's in excess of 1,000 years for man's storehouse of knowledge to double the first time. And now our knowledge of the world around us doubles. I believe it's down to once every 3 years. And part of that is because of computers, and they're able to model so many things. And it's just within the last few years that we've begun to learn about the human genome, and we've mapped the human genome, and that's allowed us to put together mRNA virus or vaccines. And so you ask the question, how is a religion that's thousands of years old be relevant in a world where knowledge is constantly expanding? Sometimes the question is put to us this way: isn't religious truth of a fundamentally different content and conveyance separate from empirical truth or empirically discovered truth? And that just means the truth that we discover by looking at the world. How do scientific discoveries and everyday experiences relate to revealed truth that comes from God? And so we'll try in the course of our discussion here to come up with an answer to that kind of question. Isn't religious truth subjectively determined by every person? And because it's subjectively determined by every person, and remember, that's an assertion that religious truth is subjectively determined. If it's subjectively determined, isn't it private and unchallengeable? And isn't it likely to vary from person to person? In other words, I know something or I believe something. How on earth is it possible for you to question my belief it's not like yours, but how is it possible for you to question my belief? Scientific understanding has proven, at least for the most part, that almost nothing can be perfectly measured. Our ability to measure almost everything is expanding exponentially. When you think about it, our scientific ability to measure things depends on the instruments that we have to measure things. If you've been in my office, you know I have a timer that's sitting on my shelf. It's a sand in an hourglass, and that was a very good way to measure time, at least thousands of years ago. My sand timer has lost time. It used to be an hour timer when I first got it. Now it's a 27-minute timer because some of the sand has escaped from the hourglass. The ability that we have to measure time is critical to the ability that we have to circumnavigate the globe. Until you could effectively measure time, you couldn't know where you were on the globe. And that's an amazing thing. Just to think about the ability to more precisely measure things means that science is just exploding. Now we measure time against the vibration of a particular atom, and I can't even remember what the atom is, but it's a very long-lived atom, and we measure time now using that atomic clock. I have a grandfather clock in my house, and my grandfather clock is based on the whole notion that a second is the amount of time that it takes for a pendulum of 1 meter length to traverse one time. But as it gets cold, the pendulum shrinks and a second changes. As it gets warm, the pendulum increases. All the metal expands and the pendulum increases. And so my clock tends to slow down. And it's all because of the changing weather that's around me. As we learn to observe things, and as we get better at observing things, that means that knowledge changes, or does it? Is there a truth? Is there knowledge that is constant? And I guess what it all boils down to is, does any real truth exist? And it's pretty much like the statement in John the 18th chapter. What is truth? Is there anything that I can say is always true and will never, no matter how good we get at measuring things, be disproven?
Dean?
Yeah.
Well, the Bible says that God is unchanging.
That's
so he
true.
Has always been the same through time. So if you look at God all the way through time, then you can understand God. The Word, the Holy Spirit, the Bible is a living word. It's not a dead piece of words. It's, you look at a verse and one time you see something and the next time it's like, well, why didn't I see that? It's living in your heart. But the things that most people are going to do is, gravity is unchanging. I'm sorry, what goes up must come down. Our perception of gravity, with little people in squirrel suits and flying in airplanes and going up in jets and stuff, has changed. But the truth of gravity will always be, like God, the truth of God, it's unchanging. And science has laws that are unchanging, just like God.
Good point. Good point. But people would argue that our understanding of gravity is not the same as the understanding of gravity that existed, 100 years ago? You know, we measure it more precisely. Does that indicate that the very concept of gravity changed? Or is it just I begin to understand it better? Now that'll be important. So let's look at, like Carol was suggesting, let's look at some of the things that we can learn biblically about the nature of truth, about the nature of knowledge.
Dean?
Yeah.
If you turn back the page there, along with what Carol had to say, how can one person impose their religious convictions? I can remember years ago, I asked that question to a minister at the Church of Christ in Albany. It was a different place and everything. And I asked him, it was something that was similar. And he says, well, first of all, he says, it's not their religious. Like Carol said, God's unchanging. It's God's convictions. And I think we have to look at that. I don't know, because I already have went off once and come back because I don't know, the fog out here or whatever, but where you're asking here with a different set of life experiences, I didn't know what you meant by that. And if you did already explain it, I'm sorry, because like I said, I froze up on out here. So,
okay. Well, let's think about how our life experiences color the things that we see. Just in the past, 2 years, we've been hearing a lot about how some people look at the police very differently than other people look at the police. You know, I look at the police and their activity as someone who is doing their best to keep me safe. And I suppose there are some people who look at the police who have a very different experience than I do, who would say the police are something to be feared. I didn't grow up in Nazi Germany. I've never experienced that kind of thing where if there's a knock on the door and you look through the peephole in your door and it's the police, my first thought is, thank goodness they're here. The first thought of some people is, oh no, they're going to arrest me. So our experiences color what we see. The question is that something that's within the nature of truth, or is that just experience speaking? And we'll try to answer that question as we look at some biblical information. And like you say, Richard, as we try to understand even our own experience. Kim keeps telling me I have to be more careful about how I say things. You know, I talk about the love of a parent is something that we can always rely on. And in my experience, that's true. The love of a parent never fails. It never goes away. But what do you say to somebody who grew up in an abusive kind of home? where parents were to be feared. They didn't love, they abused. Now, it's true that they shouldn't have done that. There's no question about that, but that colors your impression of everything that you hear. So we're going to try to go through this and establish a Christian worldview. And that Christian worldview is based on some things that I think go beyond experience. They go beyond the knowledge that I have. They're never going to be impacted by the knowledge that I have, by my experience. Can somebody read Proverbs 1 at verse 7? It's the same almost word for word statement is made in Proverbs 9 at verse 10. So we're not going to look at that one. But somebody, can you read Proverbs 1 at verse 7?
I've got that, Dean. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction.
Okay. So the fear of the Lord, the proper relationship with the Lord, not being terrified of God, that's not the real root meaning of that term, fear. Fear instead is having the proper understanding of God. And if we have that proper understanding of God, that's the beginning of knowledge. Every bit of knowledge rests in God. It comes from God. It emanates from God. If God made the world and he sustains the world, so everything is going to get back to God. And he says, the fool despises knowledge. Fools and wise men are often contrasted in the book of Proverbs. And that's really not an insult in Proverbs. The way we think of calling somebody a fool as would be an insult. A man who is foolish is just not listening to knowledge, not appreciating everything that there is to know. And freely admit that very often I have been foolish. I have not listened to knowledge. I just didn't pay attention to the information that was out there. I kind of went on my own merry way. And yes, that's what I chose to do, but that doesn't change the nature of truth. That doesn't change the nature of the things that I know. It just changes the way that I appropriate those things that I know. And, oh, goodness, that happens all the time. Other comments about how God is the beginning of knowledge and wisdom.
Dean?
Yeah, Lee?
In Proverbs 10 is a companion verse to what we've just been studying. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom.
Right.
And the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding.
Right.
And if you think about it, let's take the subject of forgiveness. The world has an entirely different knowledge or wisdom of forgiveness. But when you start to learn how to forgive the way God shows you how to forgive, and the way Jesus demonstrated forgiveness and God demonstrated forgiveness, your knowledge is wise compared to what the earth says about forgiveness.
Good point. Good point. That's, you know, that's the point that we've been making consistently all year. We learn to live in a broken world using a broken world's tools. And there are better tools. You're going to have to get those from God, because that's the only place that you're going to find them. Who wants to deal with everything that happens using a broken world's tools? We sometimes think that, or we sometimes accept a broken view of what peace really is. Because we look around us and we think, well, this is the best that peace could be. And that's not enough. That's not what the peace is that God describes. But the broken world can't give you that kind of peace. So I guess what I'm saying is, don't settle for the broken world, the best that the broken world can do. That's not enough. There's more to it than that. But because we've done our best to deal with a broken world using a broken world's tools, we think that if we're doing the best we can, then that's the best that we can hope for. That's not true.
Dean?
Yeah.
I go back this morning to the first John, or second John class, and I was talking about Cain,
mm-hmm.
and how God told Cain that all he had to do was do right, do what was right. But Cain had that knowledge. He had it before. He had it after he had God's disapproval. And I think he figured he couldn't hate God, so he hated his brother. So he had no wisdom with his knowledge.
Yeah, you could be right. You could be right. He's thinking based on the best he could do. And we always get stuck when we do that. Other comments? Okay. Second thing about the Christian's worldview. And we'll be talking about Old Testament wisdom literature a lot, because this genre of literature is kind of where you see these things discussed. Thinking about knowledge and thinking about how I know what I know and thinking about what's truth. This is just kind of, it's kind of the heart of the Bible. And that's really what this is all about. So when we think about Old Testament wisdom literature, and we think about truth, and we think about the wisdom that's portrayed, how do you see that? Do you see it as basically theological, or is it basically moral, or is it basically programmatic? Pragmatic, excuse me, not programmatic, but pragmatic. How do you see Old Testament wisdom literature? Let's just look at Proverbs, the second chapter. And can I get somebody to read verse 2 and then verse 6 and then verse 9?
I can read that.
Okay.
So that you incline your ear to wisdom and apply your heart to understanding. He said 2.
And then 6.
For the Lord gives wisdom, from his mouth come knowledge and understanding.
And in verse 9.
Then you will understand righteousness and justice, equity in every good path.
Okay. So when you think about truth, and these are statements that are for the most part repeated. Let's look at these other statements. Proverbs 3. And we'll look at, verses 2 through 4. Can you get somebody to read that one?
For length of days and years of life and peace, they will add to you. Do not let kindness and truth leave you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart. So you will find favor and good repute in the sight of God and man.
Okay. And can I get somebody to read chapter 7, beginning at verse 1, and read down through verse 5?
My son, keep my words and treasure my commandments within you.
My son, keep my words.
Go ahead, Dean. Go ahead.
No, you're fine. I like your reading better.
Thank you. My son, keep my words and treasure my commandments within you. Keep my commandments and live, and my teaching as the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, you are my sister, and call understanding your intimate friend, that they may keep you from adulteress, from the foreigner who flatters with her words.
Okay. Yeah, you're finished.
Yes, thank you.
So how do you, when you look at truth, how do you see it? Is it mostly theological or moral or pragmatic or something else?
Pragmatic. Should be all of the above.
Yeah.
Okay. How can you expand on that idea that it's all of the above?
Well, it encompasses what you learn, the way you conduct your life according to God's will.
Okay. Other thoughts? You know, I was getting news feeds all the time that come across my computer. And one of the news feeds that came across my computer today was a study that had been done that said that there is an activity that will almost double the probability that you will be divorced at some point. Do you know what that activity is? What would be your guess?
Lying?
Nope, but that would do it.
Adultery, for one thing.
Well, we'll rule out adultery. Any other ideas what that might be? One thing that you could do that would almost double the probability that you would be divorced at some point.
Argue about money.
Okay. That we know that that's a problem, but that's not it.
Lack of communication.
So, again, good answer, but that's not the thing.
Pornography.
Nope, that's not the thing either.
Well,
no.
I'm sorry.
Lee said drugs. I say not picking up after yourself.
Well, both of those are going to get you in trouble, but that's not the thing. The thing, not the thing that was.
Maybe it's that you don't have the same. You don't have the same togetherness. You have different ideas and different beliefs and things like that. So you have nothing in common or enough in common.
Good. Yeah, and you're right. That's going to get you in trouble.
Or not understanding each other, what you're saying.
Well, that's true. And all of these are good answers. But you know, the one thing that will almost double the probability that you'll be divorced is having children before you get married.
That could happen, yeah.
Yeah. Almost doubles the probability that you will be divorced.
And that can be because if you had a child out of marriage anyhow, it was an accident, then it messes everything all up. Because they either say you get married or not, and then you're ruined everybody's life.
That's true. So I guess my question is, is that a moral issue or is it a pragmatic issue? And I think it gets back to what Lenny was saying. You know, God said that there's a way for people to have children. You get married, you have children. And it's supposed to be in that order. Okay? So when we talk about the probability that you're going to be divorced doubling because you have children before you get married, is that theological? Is it moral? Is it pragmatic? Or is it, like Lenny said, it's all three of them interacting? It all comes together. Yes, it's, God said, here's the order. You marry, you have children. There's a moral imperative there. And there's a pragmatic imperative there. You know, we ignore a lot of the pragmatic issues because they don't fit what we think it ought to be. And we do that at our own peril. Usually those pragmatic issues have to do with something that God said. But because we ignore the pragmatic issues, we create problems for ourselves. I've been doing a lot of research about abortion. And it, to the extent that we participate in abortion, we increase the probability of really disturbing mental problems later in life. I was just reading an article about marijuana, and the increase in marijuana use is, Nolan was talking about this at lunch. If you have an underlying susceptibility to schizophrenia and you use marijuana, it really impacts the probability that you will develop schizophrenia in your life. And schizophrenia, we know, is at least in part hereditarily determined. So when we talk about theological truth, and we talk about moral truth, we talk about pragmatic truth, we sometimes do that because we're trying to categorize truth and say, well, that's just theological truth. And because it's just theological truth, you take it over there in the corner and you do that, that's yours. But the pragmatic truth, that's something else. And the two kinds of true things are in fact interrelated. Solomon said, if you want to avoid the adulterous woman, then keep yourself. If you want to avoid the difficulties that come with sexually transmitted diseases, the key is not wear a condom. The key is keep yourself. If you want to avoid having babies before you're married, the key is not a condom. The key is keep yourself. You can't separate theological truth, pragmatic truth, moral truth into these separate bins and say, yes, we need to be united in terms of pragmatic truth, but we can all be different in terms of theological truth. It doesn't work that way. The Christian's worldview is that wisdom, truth, is the same no matter what realm we're dealing with. Now, the manifestations may be different, but the truth is the same. And I think that's really important because you can't pull it apart and say, this is theological truth. You can argue about that. That can be one way or another. This is pragmatic truth over here. And that we can measure. So there's a reason we need to be united in terms of pragmatic truth. You know, if you want to avoid illness, you need to take steps to limit your risk of infection. Duh. Kim has often reminded me that I sometimes talk about theological truth, but you cannot ignore the well, duh part of that. What does that mean? Where's the application? Yes, there's one God. That's important. You can prove that. You can construct these beautiful arguments that, yes, there's one God. What does that mean? That has a pragmatic impact. It has a moral impact. Other thoughts?
In the Old Testament, God had certain dictates about what food you could or couldn't eat. And I suppose that would be theological because that's what he said. But then it protected the people from things they didn't know about. Diseases, for example, that those animals carried that would wipe out the Jews if they ate it. He was always protecting his people in ways that only now do we see that. We can see that. Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Faye. You know, during the Civil War, people didn't understand the relationship between bacteria and illness. And they used to put their latrines in the center of the camp, right next to the well where they got their water. And you know, I look at that and say, well, that was not a good idea. But they didn't understand that. If you look at the way that God laid out the camp in the Old Testament, that's exactly what he was doing. He's saying, put your latrine on this side, put your well on the other side. Don't eat certain kinds of meat because, or not because, that's a mistake. But like Faye said, God is protecting you. Don't eat certain kinds of meat. There are diseases that are associated with certain kinds of meat. Today we know that you can safely eat pork, but you have to cook it to a specific temperature. If you don't, you're not going to kill the diseases that typically are present, you're not going to kill the bacteria that's typically present in pork. So, yeah, I, I cook my meat all the time with a meat thermometer. I cook chicken to 165 degrees. That way I'm sure that I kill the bacteria. Yeah.
I can't substantiate this, but I remember hearing once that during the Black Plague, that they found that Jewish towns that only had Jews in it that had certain regulations, they could see that they weren't getting the Black Plague as much, like Faye said. And so it did get some people a greater understanding of that from the pragmatic point of view, I guess.
That's interesting. I've not read that, but it wouldn't surprise me if that was the case. So I guess my point here is, don't ever let anybody separate truth into different buckets and say that those buckets don't have anything to do with each other, because they do. Let's look at a couple of passages that talk about God's knowledge. Can somebody read Romans 11:33?
Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and unfathomable his ways.
Okay. Unsearchable are his judgments. This is why a statement like this is exactly why I always try to be careful to say, I know why God said don't eat pork because of diseases. I may be right, and there may be something else there. God's ways are unsearchable. They're not dependent upon my limited ability to figure out why God said it. And I always try to be careful. I slip into saying, well, I know why God said don't eat pork. I know why God said don't eat this, don't eat that. Why God said don't eat roadkill or the animal that you find dead. And it's because of bacteria. Well, maybe that was it. Maybe that's not all that's there. God's ways are unsearchable. They're much deeper than the way that I look at things. Can somebody read Isaiah 40, and then we'll have an opportunity to comment on these two passages. Isaiah 40, verses 12 through 17.
I would like to do that.
Okay.
I have always thought that Isaiah 40 was just a favorite of mine. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens by the span and calculated the dust of the earth by the measure, and weighed the mountains in a balance and the hills in a pair of scales? Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or as his counselor has informed him? With whom did he consult who gave him understanding, and who taught him in the path of justice and taught him knowledge and informed him of the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket, and are regarded as a speck of dust on the scales. Behold, he lifts up the islands like fine dust. Even Lebanon is not enough to burn, nor its beast enough for a burnt offering. All the nations are as nothing before him. They are regarded by him as less than nothing and meaningless.
So how would you describe God's knowledge?
Incomparable.
Okay. Good word.
What was that word?
Say it again.
Incomparable.
Okay, thank you.
He's above all things. He knows all things, and there's nothing beyond him. He has all knowledge. You can't even compare with him.
That's true.
Anyway.
True.
And what he made, it was spoken and it was done. He didn't have to put a watch together to make it run or something like that. And, you know, he created it from nothing. His knowledge is beyond all comprehension, really.
True. Good point. I've heard it often said that if the earth was as little as 100 miles closer to the sun in its orbit, or as much as 100 miles further from the sun in its orbit, the earth would be uninhabitable. I don't know if that's true or not. And people look at that and say, I know why God put us where he put us. To make the earth inhabitable. I'm just not sure that's me saying, God, I recognize how smart you are. You did a good job. And I don't think God cares. It's the height of arrogance for us to say, I know why God put us in exactly the place where he put us. And I know why God let the atmosphere be exactly the thickness that it is all the way around the earth. I don't know that.
But we can assume it because they created the earth for man and made everything perfect for man to live in. And then, of course, man sinned, but he made it for man. And so everything around it was created first, and man was on the planet Earth.
That's true. In a way,
we do know.
That's true.
But I wouldn't argue it scientifically at all.
That's true. God could have put us 100 miles closer to the sun and made us very different. Could have put us 100 miles further from the sun and made us very different. All that we can say is that there's an amazing correlation between the way God made things and the things that we see around us.
The dovetailness of nature, how the ecosystems all interrelate, are just mind-boggling. And that you can have a hummingbird, and then you can have flowers that look like hummingbirds and leaves that look like hummingbirds, and the colors that God, he's just fantastic.
Right. And we come to appreciate it, and we're thankful that God made it the way he did and created orderliness. And created it so that we could understand. Think what it would be like to live in a world that was chaotic, where there were no rules that governed what happened. But we don't have to live in that kind of a place. God made rules, and really all that we do with science is we discover the rule. We don't make the rule. We just discover the way things work. And that's fantastic. But then it's the height of arrogance to say, I know why God made it that way. You don't know why God made it. You may be thinking 180 degrees off. There might be some other reason why God made it that way. But it's important for us to ponder the nature of knowledge and the nature of truth. There's more to this. There's probably two more lessons that we'll spend talking about epistemology and talking about the nature of truth. I think this is really, really important for Christians. Anything else that you'd like to add before we bring this to a conclusion tonight?
Only that so many times I think about God and all that he does, all that he's done, and I just shake my head and I smile and I just say, you're just so awesome, you know, just so awesome. It's what else, you know? Thank you.
Right.
Dean?
Yeah, Carol?
You talk about the presumption of us to know God and understand what he's doing. It reminded me of an old joke about the two scientists who figured out how to create life, and they challenged God to a duel. And so they got out there, they got dirt from the earth, and God says, oh no, you have to create your own dirt.
Yeah, good point. No, you don't get to start with the stuff that I gave you.